Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the People Still Read Books podcast. I am Will Leach, your host. For now, I have not been usurped. There's been no coup of hosts. Why would there be? I produce this thing. I have to be the host. I'm the only one making it. Anyway, reminder that the People Still Read Books podcast is not just a way to connect with other authors about their book experience, to talk about their books, but also a way to both track and, yes, promote my own book, which comes out May 11th, 2021. It is called How Lucky, produced by Harper's, released by Harper's, not Harper's Magazine, not like the big cancel culture letter. I mean like Harper, the book place, different places. Anyway, I'm keeping people abreast of how the book's going on because, again, I produce the thing, so I can keep this in. The book, this week we got the bound manuscripts. Now, bound manuscripts are different than galleys. Harper makes bound manuscripts to send out to blurbers for those who want to endorse the book, who want to say, this is a good book. I'm a writer that would keep, would want my name associated with this book. I blurbed a few books myself, probably reducing any resale value they would have by my very name being on the book. But we've sent that out to authors that I admire, some people I know. Hopefully they will read the book and like the book. Eventually, when the book is actually released to the wild, it will be its own madness. But for now, it's somewhat disorienting because so few people have actually read the book. Now I'm sending it to actual professionals who have written books before. The first people look at it, a little bit scary. But a bound manuscript is a little bit different than galley in that the book has not been copy edited, for example. There's no acknowledgments, no index. Though it's a novel. I guess I don't know why there would be an index in a novel. But nevertheless, the book itself is being read by people right now who are not either paid to look at it or decided not to pay to look at it or are not, I guess, living in this house. Anyway, so there's your update on How Lucky, just because I have to remind you that's why we're doing this podcast in the first place. As always, follow us, and by that I mean me, on Twitter, at StillReadBooks. Email me at peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com if you'd like to have your podcast on, or you'd like to have your author on. If you talk about your book, talk about an author you represent, just whatever you want to do. Email me, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com. Give this podcast a review, by the way, preferably on iTunes @Apple Podcasts. Helps people find it. Helps people know it exists. This week, I am delighted to have R.J. Young as my guest. R.J. Young is the author of Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. He is also a radio host and sports guy for ESPN Radio. And he just signed a book. New book, his next project, which I will ask him about. I do ask him about. I've actually already done the interview. Is about the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. It's called Requiem for a Massacre. He lives in Tulsa and knows that very well. He is a very smart guy. And sadly, poor for him, an Oklahoma football fan. But nevertheless, R.J. Young is a terrific dude. You can follow him on Twitter at @RJ_Young. The book is fascinating. I'll let him tell the story of it, but basically it is about a man who marries into a family whose his wife's father is a gun nut in Oklahoma. So he feels like he needs to learn about gun culture and kind of what that says about white gun culture and black gun culture and what it means, what guns mean in the crossover of those two worlds. It's an excellent book. And he's also a pretty smart sports person, actually. Anyway, remind you as always, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com, still read books on Twitter. Holler at me anytime. But for now, here is R.J. Young. I am delighted to have on as my guest today on episode 5. I believe it's episode 5 of the People Still Write Books podcast. It is R.J. Young. He's an ESPN radio guy. You'll be able to tell when he talks that he is a terrific radio voice guy. I'm a podcast voice guy, which is to say I stammer a lot and I say a lot of ums and I get confused and I go on little tangents that don't make any sense and are definitely not applicable to the conversation at all. But you're a radio person, so you actually stay focused and sound like a solid radio person. So first off, bear with me as I ask you terrible questions that take forever to get out, like this one. Secondly, hi, how are you? The book is Let It Bang, a young black man's reluctant odyssey into guns. RJ, thank you for coming on with me.
No, Will, thank you for having me.
Oh, well, you know what? We're both welcome. So first off, I've a couple things I want to get into before we get into to talk about the book, because you have another book coming up that seems like a very exciting project. But first off, we have to talk about something sad, something more recently unfortunate, which is you are quite famously, I think, a big Oklahoma football aficionado. I would say expert. I would classify you as both of those things. What's going on over there? The quarterback, Johnny Rattlesnake or whatever his name is. What's happened over there? I'm friends with Brandon Sneed, who just wrote a book about your coach over there. It's a good book. And I was very excited to see Oklahoma football make the next thing. Is everybody okay? How are they handling it down there with this slow start to the season?
Well, first, Brandon's book is awesome.
It is good, right? Yeah, it's really good.
It's awesome. And he did that without any help from Lincoln Riley. So I was very impressed. But hey, man, like this is what I've been expecting for 10 years for Oklahoma. Like it's been really good to be an OU fan the last 20 years. You know, one national championship, but you're always there. And it's a really interesting year because you got a redshirt freshman quarterback who's really talented, but you're young everywhere. Offensively, and then defensively, you're, well, dumpster fire. Right. So we're going to ride it. We got Texas this weekend. We'll see how that goes. But I don't know if I can handle going 0-3, start Big 12 play and losing to Texas. That might break me.
Well, I always feel bad. I am a big Illinois person. So I'm just really glad that like Skip Bayless isn't associated with my university. I always feel very fortunate about that. I always feel very fortunate that I don't have to have him follow me around and write about my team all the time. Okay, so I'm going to pause for a second. Someone has called me 11 times from an 800 number, and I'm going to try to make them go away. Sorry about that. Sheesh. No, okay, no. Stop, person. Okay, edit that out. Okay, sorry about that. I was having trouble asking my question because someone called me 8 times from an 800 number. I'm sure it's just my child desperate in need of support. Okay, here we go. just kidding. Here we go. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Okay, so I want to get into the project you're working on next in a bit. But first, I really want to talk about this book. It's really a fascinating book because you and I, we have different backgrounds, but we share something very much, which is to say we have grown up in places and been around people who are really into guns. And at least for a long time, we were not. Now, you solved that problem, so to speak, by taking gun classes and becoming actually an instructor yourself, in large part to bond with your then father-in-law. I have not done that. I have not done that. I am actually still quite terrified of guns. But I'm curious, you know, one of the things that I think is really fun and smart about this book is, in addition to everything else going on, is watching you go from the general like bewilderment of, oh, hello, father of the person that I am with and am in love with. It's nice to meet you. Why are you handing me a gun? That's a weird thing to do in the first 15 to 20 seconds to becoming an expert in the idea. Talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about kind of that process of what it felt like to realize and what made you decide I need to kind of like really dig deep and investigate into the world of advanced weaponry.
It's a hell of a first impression, right?
Yeah.
It's also terrifically Oklahoma in that it's a part of this culture that I had purposefully stayed away from and kind of fell face first into it when Charles handed me not just a gun, but what's called a guitarist judge. It is self-defense porn. You can cross-load it with shotgun shells and 45 long Colts, and it will do the job and then some. But he was very proud of it, and that was what took me aback. I was not ready for somebody to hand me a gun and for me to admire it to be what they had wanted. I thought that there was some real disconnect there. And then, you know, we talk about Oklahoma football. I happened to marry into the only family where the head of the family could give a damn about OU football. So I had nothing to talk about, right? Absolutely nothing. Yeah. And in trying to get to know Charles, that was what I had, was guns. I mean, he had them everywhere. They shotgun leaned up against the back door. He keeps a gun on him. He keeps a gun in his truck. I learned to bow hunt as a part of this to get to know him. And I found that the way for me to actually not just get to know him, but earn his respect was to be knowledgeable about guns. And I kept going down that rabbit hole and what it meant for me as a black man and what it meant to be in his family. And along the way, just meet some interesting people. And you'll learn a lot about this state, which is not unlike Texas and most southern states in that it's proud of its gun-toting self. And this is not, you know, it's not strange to walk in front of a Walmart and see somebody standing outside with a gun on their person, open carry. It's also not strange to see someone in Walmart with a gun on their person because this is an open carry state. You know, it's just what you do. And yet, when I take a look at that from the standpoint of being a black man, that's not what you do unless there's a riot, right? Because that's when that happened. Like, I'm thinking about the riot in Washington, D.C. in 1919. Black men picked up guns because they were getting hunted. Matter of fact, did you know this term called terror car?
I did not and do not until I read the – yeah, I don't. It seems – tell me about it. I'm afraid to ask a little.
So I think white folks invented drive-bys. Cause like these dudes got into a car, drove into the black neighborhood and sprayed at it indiscriminately. And then, you know, black folks got in their cars, went into white neighborhoods and started spraying indiscriminately in DC, right? And Woodrow Wilson's at the White House, and you have people that are pulling people off the street and beating them and shooting at them. And that is the culture for which we foster what we have now, right? And I found that to be really getting into the weeds a bit in relation to police brutality. A lot of the conversation is what should black folks be doing? And there is a contingent of black folks that I write about in the book that have decided we will shoot back. We aren't going out like that. Now, I think that there's all sorts of repercussions that people don't think through when they talk about using a firearm to defend themselves that I'm just not willing to engage in. But that's where many in the country are. And that was part of the conceit of this book.
You know, it's funny, in the last couple of years, because this book came out in 2018, and, you know, nothing has happened this year, but 2019 was a busy year. And so, you know, lots of things have happened in a way since then. And obviously with everything with the pandemic and the protests and everything else, but also the NRA itself has kind of dissolved as an organization. And I think it's funny for someone like me who is not involved with gun culture and is the parent. I live in Athens, Georgia, and which is, you know, a nice college town where REM is from here and the drive-by truckers and the B-52s. It's so nice. And so, but nevertheless, it's still, you know, a Southern town. And so, you know, at a certain level, I moved here from New York in 2013. Then I got back here and I said, okay, well, I'm going to be that parent that anytime that my friend, like my son, either one of my sons wants to spend the night at someone's house, I will ask them, do you have a gun in the house? It just feels like something I should ask. I should know, and I should know where it is. And so I'm like, responsible parent person thing. And they all looked at me like, a gun? What are you talking about? A gun? And like, we can't show you all the guns in the house, but yes, dipshit, there are guns in this house. And I had always kind of associated like, oh, well, that's the NRA. But it's funny. I do not feel like the gun world has receded in any way, shape, or form as the NRA has struggled. And it's an understanding. Like, I think if you don't really pay attention to the gun world, the NRA was like this like overarching thing, like they're the problem. But as you kind of point out, and as I've learned a lot being down here, guns are never minding just omnipresent, but like a basic part of the culture. I noticed, like you do in the book, that like they sell hollow point bullets at Academy Sports where I get my kids' uniforms for soccer. Like, there's just all sorts of things that I'm learning about. And I think you do a good job of like explaining how there is a culture of it that like is almost, I wouldn't say thoughtless, but it's just not even remarked upon or even considered of the prevalence of guns that are everywhere.
Oh, man. And the NRA's involvement stretching basically 125 years. And like, man, I reviewed this book called Policing the Second Amendment. And I believe that review comes out actually in the Sunday Times book review the Sunday that we're recording this. But I bring it up because Jennifer Carlson does a great job of outlining, did you know that the reason that police have guns is because the NRA advocated for them to have them? Can you imagine what American policing would be like if there weren't any firearms?
Different.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, you know, that sort of thing still flabbergasts me because I can't imagine what the world is like without the NRA. And I can't imagine what the world is like in America if nobody had firearms. And to your point, it's not that you have one in most cases. It's that you have more than one. Some of them are collectible. Some of them are for showing off. Some of them are for hunting, even as there are folks that hunt with what lay people would call assault rifles, right? And it's like, I don't know that you need that. Well, how do you know what I need? And you also have these people who believe that someone is going to not just take their guns, but some unnamed person is going to kick in their door and try to hurt them. And while that thing does happen, the likelihood of it happening and the preparation for you thinking it's going to happen doesn't really line up with the reality. You know, like I take the stance of, if you break into my house and you want my TV, you can have my TV. I'm not going to kill you over my TV. I'm going to choose to believe that you need it more than I do. I know people that just decide, no, that's not what's going to happen. That's my TV. And if they walked into my house, I'm going to shoot them. And we have in Oklahoma what's called the Castle Doctrine, which means that if, Will, you're walking up to my house and you got on Birkenstock sandals and socks and a tie-dye shirt that says love, and you have a big poster you're holding above your head that says, I love you, I can shoot you in the chest and call it self-defense, and then I'm not going to be criminally charged. Now, civilly charged, something else entirely, and that gets into some of those repercussions that I don't think people really consider about what it means to take a life. Because even the worst person in the world has somebody that loves them and is going to be sad that they're gone. And how does that affect your family going forward? How does that affect how people view your neighborhood, right? This also gets into the black person living next door and what they think is going to happen to property values versus what actually happens to property values. It gets into what goes on to with at the schools that are near a home where there was homicide, right? Like all of these things that really compound based on policies that we already have in place. And a lot of that starts with who has a gun and who doesn't. Because I still believe what most people believe, which is that anybody that wants a gun can get a gun. But I also believe that most of the people that want a gun don't need a gun. But try telling that to them, right? And that's where we have a tremendous disconnect. And me becoming an NRA certified basic pistol instructor is so that I could have that conversation with people who would tell me they need a firearm. And I can look them straight in the eye and say, look, I shoot better than you. Okay? I score 95% on my efficiency test and my accuracy test. One of the proudest moments I had with Charles was showing him the target that I used where I qualified. And it was a lot harder and a lot more harrowing than you might expect. I spent a lot of time at gun range. I spent a lot of time learning how to shoot. And I only had the one firearm that I used to qualify. And the Glock 17 was my preferred weapon. The baby Glock was something that came before. So I had the baby Glock because I wanted to get to know Charles and get to shoot. And then when I decided that I wanted to learn to be a basic pistol instructor, I picked up a second firearm, and that became my primary means for practice. But I picked a Glock 17 because Raylan Givens had a Glock 17. I'm dead serious.
Like, that's an excellent reason.
Elmore Leonard is my favorite novelist.
Right, of course. Oh yeah.
I don't know what that means to most people, but I own every Elmore Leonard novel there is to own. I own all the short stories. I mean, I'm that guy. So there was no question to me. But there's also this idea that the Glock is very efficient. If you're going to be a novice shooting a firearm, it's one that I would recommend because using a revolver, especially a larger revolver, right, is not going to be simple for you to shoot. Yet there are people that still believe I need a revolver because they believe somehow that it's much more reliable. And this gets into gun culture and what Western enthusiasts believe versus what's American made, which is another discussion, which I was very interested in because the Glock is Austrian made, right? Gaston Glock, who was going to make curtain rods and then went to the Austrian government who found out that, you know, they said, we need a new gun. He says, can I bid on that? Can I try to submit something? They're like, you make curtain rods. It's like, yeah, but can I? Yeah, sure, whatever. And he came up with what I think is the most efficient handgun ever. And it's so efficient that I kind of wish that we could uninvent it. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that exist that I wish that we could uninvent, actually, these things that are coming out all over the place. If Glocks and social media, I think, are maybe the first two orders on both of these. I am curious, about, like, because you really do a really great job, like, kind of going into the history of, again, not just of guns, but like the NRA. And, like, to me, one of the most fascinating things, this was something I knew, but you go into a lot of good detail about, is how, like, it reminded me very much of Philando Castile in Minnesota, how the NRA in 1968 was supporting a gun control act because Black Panthers were getting guns. And I think this is really interesting. There's this section where you talk about the white NRA and the Black NRA, and you talk about the National African American Gun Association and the differences in that. And you talk to people in that group. I'm curious that, like, do you feel it, what are the differences? Like, to me, the NRA doesn't, I guess in its death spiral now, but at the end, it did not seem to be about guns, or at least not primarily about guns. Guns were almost the avatar or the symbol for what they were really for. And I think you saw that with Philando Castile. I'm curious, did you find talking to the people of the National African American Gun Association, do they feel kind of what you talked about earlier of the idea of that, like, their relationship with guns different than the NRA's relationship with guns?
Their relationship is different with race. And the only thing they agree on is that, yes, we need the firearm. After that, they don't agree.
Right, that's it. Right.
Yeah. And I think that that's accurate on both sides, right? I don't think the NRA cares about NAGA. I don't think NAGA particularly cares about NRA, except that it's the most powerful lobbying force, or was, in America. And that was also interesting because, like, nobody from the NRA would talk with me. So that didn't surprise me. But it also is in keeping with how they go about business. Whereas NAGA, they were very much, hey, look, we are trying to create a culture that fosters healthy gun ownership among Black Americans, because this was something that was not always a right that we had, which we could say about a lot of rights for Black folks in the United States. And that is an interesting space to own a gun from, right? So, like, I still own my firearms, but they stay locked up and, you know, in a cool, dry place where nobody can get to them. They're glorified paperweights because, you know, Gun Control Act of 1968, and even before that, the Ku Klux Klan lived to go into your house and take your firearms. So much so that Ida B. Wells is like, hey, look, every Black person needs a Winchester, and they need it on the mantle. And you need to be able to use it and be willing to use it should the time arise, because the time will arise. And this goes into the nadir in the late 19th century, around the Panic of 1893, into what is called the Roaring Twenties. But throughout United States history, the one thing that white folks have seemed to agree on is, I don't know, that's always a good idea that Black folks have guns. And then they go to war and you give them the gun. And they come back and they say, okay, you got to give us that back. No, I don't. Like, this was interesting in Civil War. They could not pay Union soldiers at the end of the war, especially if they were Black. So they said, hey, just keep the uniform and the gun. And Confederate soldiers who had lost were like, hey, wait, they don't need those. It's like, yeah, they do. We can't pay them. No. They're going to use that to defend themselves. Why is that such a bad thing? You use it to defend yourself. Yes, well, I'm white. And then we get that real interesting conversation to go. And that's where I think NAGA exist. They exist to remind all of us, hey, look, there was a time when they took these away. That means that the time can come. And I think about, like, the Voting Rights Act, gutted in 2013. How many people quite literally died and suffered so that I could put a piece of paper into a box. And now to know that it might not count in the way that it used to count is debilitating. Again, an interesting space to start a conversation with when we're talking about guns, because we can get all the way back through basic human rights and what it means to be a person and three-fifths a person. And I can go on, so I'm going to stop.
Well, I guess that leads really a lot. I'm fascinated that you say your book came out in 2018, but, you know, really to me, the issues like guns are obviously a big part of this and the central aspect of all of it. But, you know, what I kind of mean about the guns as the avatar is that like they've book like guns are about power, and really all of this is about power. And I think that to me, the NRA, that's what I mean, was less about guns. And I remember when they had the NRA TV channel, and it was like partly about guns, but it was really about, hey, here are the people that watch the NRA channel, and here's what we do here. And it seemed to have gone so out of control. Now that feels like every conversation we're having in America right now in the age of the final stage, hopefully, I guess, the final stages of Trump, where it feels like there is a small group of people that are dug in and trying to hang on to power in any way that they can. I live here in Athens, and we just got rid of the Confederate monument downtown, and when they had when we had a protest here, the Boogaloo dudes came by, those Boogaloo people in their Hawaiian shirts, and it's weird. People like it, I think if you've only seen them online or you've seen them talk about it, they just seem like these pathetic, like goateed, flabby, middle-aged white dudes. But when you see them in person, they have huge fucking guns. and for me, that is, I think that it feels like so much of this is kind of coming to a head now, because I look at that and, you know, I know the Proud Boys are a different group, but this kind of idea of like white supremacy and fighting against that, on one hand, it like, I look at a lot of stuff because I'm here sitting comfortably with my happy little house here in Athens, and be like, those people are idiots. Those people are stupid. Why would anybody take them seriously at all? And then I'm at the protest downtown. I see this big fucking dude with a gun that's taller than both of my kids. And he's got two of them, and I don't think he knows how to use them. and to me, that is what it seems to be, that so much of your book is about guns and as an avatar of power, or even just an active tool of power. And it feels to very much illuminate not just everything that's happened in 2020, but frankly, what we might be looking at in the election here pretty soon. I'm curious, knowing gun culture, you have to have come across, I guarantee you, when you went to that gun show in this book, you saw some future Boogaloo boys. There is no question that that's true. And I'm curious, like, being immersed in gun culture, do you see that as a natural offspring of that group of people and that kind of gun culture?
Yes, but to your point about the Boogaloo boys, like, my best friend Ron and I have a running joke that the dude with the Hawaiian shirt and the cargo shorts is a marked tourist with a gun on. Like, that's just it, right? And it's funny because, you know, now I look at Andy Reid and it's like, you can't wear your Hawaiian shirts anymore, man. Like, Tommy Bahama's, you can't do that anymore. Like, that doesn't mean what it used to mean.
Yeah, somebody tell him.
There are some that really believe that there are ways to camouflage themselves, and wearing those shirts is one. But yeah, to your point, yeah, I did see a lot of future Boogaloo boys, but I also see a lot of people that are holding on to a way of life that has always been wrong in the way that we view race, in the way that we view socioeconomics, in the way that we view each other, right? Like, the thing that jars me is seeing the Hugo Boss inspired Nazi uniform on display for people to purchase, yeah. Right? And the idea that you can buy a firearm and, you know, nobody's going to actually check. Like, Obama ain't going to know, was what was told to me. And the proliferation of guns, large phallic symbols, right? Like, they're too big. They're bigger than your children, as ways to intimidate people. Not going anywhere, because we're not going to get rid of guns. Like, it still boggles my mind that we have more guns in the country than we do people. more guns than people. Like, what for and why? Because we're afraid of each other? Yes. And then why are we afraid of each other? Because we don't know each other. Because we're not talking to each other. You know, I was just a couple of days ago looking at how the NAACP was formed. And a white woman named Mary Ovington reached out to W.E.B. Du Bois after the 1908 Springfield riot, which is, again, fascinating because that was the last stop of Lincoln when they were allowing him to be viewed. And 15,000 people lived in Springfield at the time. 150,000 people show up. Some of them are black. They're led by a black regiment who is very proud to be up front for the great emancipator. And then, you know, 50 years later, you have one of the worst riots and racial battles in United States history. Why? Because you feel threatened. So we had guns. So we're going to use them. And we're going to threaten these people to leave. And that's how we get into the state of, hey, can I trust this person if I don't know them? Well, yeah, you just have to actually get to know them. And that was why I wanted to write the book. Because at the time, it felt like a win in a sea of losses, right? Like, I had friends call me after Donald Trump won the presidency and said, hey, RJ, I need you to teach me how to shoot. And that was, you know, that is a really harrowing thought. That you can't actually just think nothing of the person who is president of the United States as being that. You think of that person as threatening you physically, violently. And that is what guns are about. Threatening you physically, violently. I don't know at all times what to do with that except continue to write about it.
A couple more things. I'm curious. You describe you truly do become an expert on guns this way in this book. At one point, your mother you're teaching your mother wearing her. I believe you said it was a gold and white MAGA hat. I don't know. Has she? I'm curious. Since you read the book, has your mother changed her viewpoint on Trump, or is she still a? This is a side question, but I'm just curious. Having read that part of the book.
No, my mom is still 100% riding the Donald Trump train. Well, my father, for that matter, too.
Even this week, huh?
Yeah, even this week.
Oh, wow. Okay, good. I don't mean to get sidetracked on that, but I you learned so much about guns. You become a guns marksman, and it becomes part of the thing with your then father-in-law. But I'm curious, did you, like, putting aside everything we've talked about of guns and power and guns and threatening and guns and people's own fear, the actual act of firing a gun, I know you don't, you have your gun still, but you don't, I don't know if you go shooting or you don't train anymore. Do you physically like, does it feel good for you still, knowing all the context of everything, does it feel good to shoot a gun? Like just the actual physical act of it?
No.
Yeah.
I didn't feel any powerful. Or it didn't feel powerful. I didn't get to look forward to shooting that gun. Like, I'm not Annette Bening in American Beauty. That's not me, right? I know people that feel that way, but that wasn't me.
Right.
Precisely because, like, to learn to shoot the gun correctly is to kind of be surprised when it fires, right? That's a big part of it. You're not supposed to anticipate recoil because then you'll pull it off sight. Right. And there's just little ways in which I think, not unlike baseball and learning to hit, right? There are things that you think you should do that are counterintuitive to the effort itself. You know, or I think of, you know, your piece about Bob Gibson, my favorite baseball player.
Oh yeah.
And how you might steer the ball. You're not supposed to steer the ball. You're supposed to rock and fire. Right. And that was a man that always looked like he was never trying to steer a damn thing. He was just trying to take heads off. And yet that's I think I would feel powerful throwing a baseball. Right. I don't think I would feel powerful wielding this firearm that is expressly used to kill other people. I never wanted that power. I don't desire that power. And it frightens me that so many people do.
Yeah, particularly, too, because, you know, I mentioned this a little bit with the Boogaloo Boys, but like. You write a lot about the care, and like you clearly like did like you took, you put in the time to figure out how to do, to not only use the gun correctly, but to store the gun correctly and to be safe about the gun and to know what kind of best gun to use. And so, and I saw some of those guys. I don't think they did that. That's just my personal opinion. I don't think they did that. And so for me, that it is one thing that there are all these guns, but there is another thing. This may go back to the original abdication of the NRA's initial purpose. But the whole idea was they were supposed to turn to teach gun safety. And, you know, I think someone had written a piece about the NRA TV about noting about how many people on the show clearly did not practice basic gun safety. And for me, that is another fascinating part, too, is that, like, people want it's so fun to talk to you about guns because it does feel like you have – like, you know how to use them and you respect them accordingly. It's not about anything other than knowing the correct way to use it. Whereas I see so many people with guns, it is about more. It's the gun itself is learning how to use it correctly is almost like, yeah, it's, who cares about that? I've just got one and I can do it. And to me, that is one of the scariest parts about gun culture to me is the number of people that, you know, I mean, listen, I grew up in central farm country, central Illinois. I grew up with plenty of guns, but I was raised with the idea, like, this is how you use a gun. This is how you store a gun. You put the gun. We are not obsessed with guns. We just have a gun. And you would shoot Old Yeller with it if your dog was rabid or something. But other than that, then not specifically Old Yeller. Old Yeller was a very nice dog until the end. Anyway, side the point. The point is that, like, you know, very much of there's a respect to it. It doesn't feel to me that so much is what you're talking about. It so seems based in fear and power. And that's it feels like a de-evolution of our society rather than moving in the right direction, I would say.
It feels terribly American, right? In that one of my friends is an IT professional, and he tells this joke about a dog and his owner playing fetch. And it's no throw, only fetch, right? Because you can't – the dog just wants to fetch. It doesn't want to take the ball back to you so that you could throw it, only fetch. And we think about that as it relates to walks of life in America, in that we expect that we're just going to be good at something. We expect that people are just going to give us what we want, and that this task that somebody else makes look easy, I could just do. And I think about this, you know, as a writer, when someone walks up to you and says, yeah, I got an idea for a book. Like, okay, great. Or worse yet, somebody says to you, can you write my book?
Yeah. I got stories for you. Like, I got stories for you. Right. That's my favorite one. I'll give you a story to tell.
Right. It's that. And I think that's how people approach guns, right? It's just, no, great. Somebody else is, look, I saw Denzel Washington do this. I could do it.
Oh, my God.
You know, I saw Liam Neeson do this. I saw John Wick didn't actually miss. Oh, you know, never mind that there's one, movies. Two, the training that Keanu Reeves went through was rigorous and violent and hard. And approaching a thing with reverence is to be good at it. You know, like I think about baseball. You're really good if you could do something 30% of the time. 30% of the time. No. Like that's not just success. That's obscene success. Right, somehow people think they should just be able to pick up a gun and know what to do. No, that's not how it works. And being humble about those things, I think is really difficult for a lot of people because we're Americans, right? Because we have learned to be so individualistic and we believe in exceptionalism. I don't believe in exceptionalism.
I don't know how you can now. Like you're lying to yourself, right? Like at this point, even if that's something that you were like, yeah, we're Americans, we'll figure it out. At some point, if that's something you thought in your life, I don't know how you could possibly think that now.
No, and yet the people that showed up in Athens with Hawaiian shirts on still think that.
That's what they are. Yeah, exactly. That's what they're. That's nice. Well, that's everything's coming up. Everything's coming up great. Well, I want to talk about your next book, by the way, before I let you go, because you just signed this last week, which is very exciting. Tell us about the book that you're working on now. I promise, by the way, I will ask you about this now, and then I will do the best gift you can give a writer, which is not to ask them how their book is going again for many, many months. I'll just let you write it, and then I'll read it when it comes out. I feel like all books should be talked about when the deal is signed, and then when it is finished and published, and we should be left alone otherwise a little bit. But I'm curious. This is a very exciting book. Tell me about the book, the deal that you just signed that you're working on now.
First, amen. Talk about it. Yes, when we sign it, and then don't talk to me for a year. Don't ask me about it for a year.
Wasn't that a thing with that Barack Obama got annoyed with Michelle about, because like her book came out and sold really well, and people kept asking him, "How's the book going, boss? How's the book going?" Right. He's like, "Leave me alone."
And he threw her under the bus at one point. Like, she's got ghostwriters. I was dying. And you know, she's got the one book, and he's writing volumes. You know, yeah. He's like, "Leave me alone. Stop asking me about it. I want to go play golf."
And he's late on it, and he shirts is out and bestseller already. Oh, it's great.
It's my favorite, because that's how I know he's a writer.
Exactly. But. Sorry, tell me about your new book.
My book is called Requiem for the Massacre, and it's about a reflection and history of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. I'm from Tulsa. I still live here today. I went to high school here, went to the University of Tulsa, and I had wanted to write this book since high school, since I was at Booker T. Washington. Didn't graduate from Booker T. I graduated from Memorial, but my English teachers put me onto this, and I've been fascinated with it. And I'm also angry that people that live here don't know this history. And yet you look around for Black histories of the Tulsa race massacre, and you are really going to come up short. So the conceit of this was to write a blend of memoir and research reportage history, illustrating the tension in Tulsa in 1921 and after, with how the city hasn't really wrestled with it they didn't wrestle with it for about 75 years. So there's about 75 years where nobody talked about it, so much so that one of the TU professors, now passed, name is Nancy Feldman. She's a really great woman. Learned about this when she moved from Chicago with her husband, Ray. And a fella named Robert Fairchild told her about it. And she said, "Man, I got to tell my students about this." She's teaching law school at the University of Tulsa Law. And she had students that yelled in her face that this was not true, because if this were true, I would have heard about it. I'm from here. And she was also told later, "Don't bring this up. Don't talk about this," which is how the city reacted to it. And there's this whole just sordid omission about what transpired here and what has happened since. And I'm really going to dig into not just the racial tension, but how the policies that shaped it have shaped this city. I mean, even now, like, there's a Black Lives Matter mural that was painted 300 feet long on Greenwood, which is where this massacre took place 100 years ago. And the city chose to scrape 2 inches of pavement up so that they didn't have to have that mural there, because a couple of people got mad about it. Same group of people, I'm sure, that threw blue paint on it. Same group of people that asked if they could put up a Blue Lives Matter on their street. And when the Arts Commission said, "Hey, look, we think you should adopt this as public art, even though it was not permitted. There are lots of people that want to see this here." And our mayor said, "No, I think this has to come up." And in that way, you're once again erasing the story and the pain, and you're not wrestling with it at all. You're just choosing to omit it. And that's what I wanted to write about, and what I wanted to get at is, to wrestle with something, you actually have to have it in your face. You actually have to talk about it at length over and over again, and you can never choose to forget it. And I feel that we did that. We chose to forget a group of white folks showing up to the Black part of town, burning it down, pillaging, raping, killing black folks. So much so that, like, there's stories all over about this place. Like, nobody heard about the Tulsa Massacre until Watchmen?
Watchmen, right, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going...
So many people, yeah.
I was so angry about that, right? I listened to Colson Whitehead talk about Nickel Boys here not too long ago, and he says, yeah, I didn't know about the Tulsa Massacre till like, 2012. And I get livid about that because I feel that if more people knew, we might be a little bit better off. So I wanted to write the book, and I feel very, very humble and proud to be able to do it, because being able to do it at a publishing house like mine, Counterpoint Press, is not the kind of gift that many writers get, let alone black writers. So this has a tremendous amount of my headspace, even as I try to talk about sports for my job.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that really getting up, getting in. Like, so what's that? What's Sam Pittman doing at Arkansas? Can feel like a little like compartmentalization probably going. Well, I cannot wait to read that book. I will have you on if you will let me. When that comes out, but I will, again, my solemn gift to you, I will not ask you about it until then. I won't say a word about it. I'll just let you do it. I'll just let you do it and let you get them. Cause again, it feels, I made the mistake. I'm curious if you've done this before. I made the mistake of, I've got a novel coming out in May. I made the mistake of right before it went up for sale of mentioning it to a few people that I'd written it. And then it took like, you know, a little longer to sell than I thought it was going to. And so I had to do that question, every answer. Oh, it's on its way. It's, lots of going on. Crazy business books, blah, blah, blah. And like, I should have never mentioned in the first place. So I cannot wait to read this book, and I will leave you be on it. My last question, however, that I ask this of every author on the show, what did you do when you first got the first physical copies of your book? I mean, I don't know if you got like a box of them or how it worked, but like, what was that feeling like when you got the book for the first time and physically held it in your hands?
Fucking relief, man. Like, it doesn't feel real. Like, it doesn't. And to your point about, you know, telling people that you have this thing up for sale, I am the worst person to ask that about. Because, like, even my family, like my girlfriend, my mother, my best friends, they know, don't ask me. I'm going to get belligerent. I'm going to get angry. I don't want to talk about it because it's still a thing that can go away. Like, I was afraid of talking about getting this book deal agreed to until I signed my contract. I'm that guy. So I totally feel you. So when the book finally gets to you, and you pick up your galleys, and then you get to your hardback, and you're going, holy shit, this is real. Like, people are actually going to buy this. I hope. You know what? Fuck it. I got it. You know, it's like that's where I was. I was screaming in my studio apartment, and I did get a noise complaint.
That's okay. You earned it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, no, write me up. I'll pay the fine. I got a book.
Seriously. Well, that's very exciting. I there should always be screaming when they come. I'm actually just getting my bound manuscripts back for blurbs in the next week, and it's really just going to look like a term paper. But nevertheless, that's just the start. Just be able to finally have it. RJ, I've really enjoyed doing this. Thank you for talking to me. I love the book, and I cannot wait for your next one. And I love. And again, now I know that every time I will watch all Oklahoma games now with you in mind. And one last question. Why is the Tulsa Hurricane mascot a tornado? Can you explain this to me?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 30s, the TU football team went through a phase of different mascots. I mean, at one point they were Tigers. At one point, I think they were the Jackets. And they settled on tornadoes. Golden Tornadoes. Fits. Tulsa, Oklahoma. We get tornadoes. And yeah. Singular, right? It was going to be Golden Tornado, not plural. And then head coach found out that Georgia Tech was the Golden Tornado. So he got up off that and decided to put it to a team vote, and they voted to be the Hurricanes. And then that became Hurricane. And then Georgia Tech naturally became Yellow Jackets, and you know, we stuck with Hurricane.
I always just thought it was impossible to personify a hurricane. Like a tornado has a shape, right? You can see that. But a hurricane is just, you know, I guess just a tree waving, perhaps. Okay, RJ Young, the book is Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. A book can be found everywhere. Congratulations on that. Congratulations on the new book. And I look forward to having you on to chat about that then when Oklahoma and Georgia are playing for the national championship and we have a natural news peg.
Hey man, I'm here for it. And I need to say, I am grateful to you. I am a Deadspin kid. I used to read it in class and get in trouble. So like, it's like, why are you reading this? Because it's awesome. I can't thank you enough for help guiding me as the kind of sports fan that I wanted to be and writing about the topics and allowing for space for us to be. I don't get to where I am unless I'm thinking about that publication in some way.
Oh, well, I started it and then everybody else made it great. But, nevertheless, I've always said that, the great thing about, Deadspin was I left early enough that, every time they would do something great, people would be like, wow, well, you must be so proud that you started Deadspin. And whenever they did something terrible, they would say, well, Will would never do that over at Deadspin. And that was like, that was right in the strike zone. Until the damn venture capital, the vulture capitalists all went and destroyed it. It was a good thing. But Defector's great. You should, for the one that's not reading Defector, you should read Defector as well. I think it's a very kind thing to say. And honestly, it's a great book. I'm embarrassed I did not know the book first because I really loved it. And obviously, I can't wait to see what you're doing next. So thank you. Be safe and continue good luck. And again, I promise, no more book asking until it comes out.
Thank you, Will.
Take care.